Lebanon's Hezbollah chief says any normalization of ties with Israel is tantamount to abandoning Palestine and playing into the enemy's hands. The Israeli regime carries out another airstrike on Syria, targeting military positions in the vicinity of the eastern city of Deir al-Zor. Thank you for joining us. Now, today's top story, the Iranian president has once again strongly condemned the recent desecration of the Holy Quran in some European countries.
Islam is a religion of freedom and equality. The Holy Quran is also a book of mercy, wisdom, and divine words. Insulting the Holy Quran as the precious miracle of the Prophet Muhammad is an insult to humanity, freedom, values, and spirituality. The Islamic Republic of Iran strongly condemns such hateful and spiteful acts that occur in some parts of the world with the aim of spreading Islamophobia. These acts also hurt the sentiments of Muslims across the globe.
Raisi made the comments in a congratulatory message to the leaders and people of Muslim countries on the auspicious occasion of the Prophet Muhammad's birth anniversary. He also called for the promotion of unity and solidarity amongst Muslim nations. The Holy Muslim Book has been desecrated in the Netherlands, Sweden and Denmark on several occasions this year. The sacrilegious acts have taken place with a go-ahead given by those countries' authorities amid protection provided by their security forces. Muslim countries across the world have held huge protests to condemn the profane move. The Iranian army's drones can easily or already counter any threat, but the force still wants to become more powerful in this sector. That's according to Rear Admiral Habibullah Sayyari, speaking as Iran's army prepares to hold large-scale joint drone drills across large parts of the country's central and southern areas.
More than 100 drills will be conducted as of tomorrow morning. That's what we're planning to do. The drills will be conducted both in daylight and at night, and in the electronic warfare atmosphere. So we should see how long our drones endure when it comes to electronic warfare.
The drills commander says Iran is boosting its defense capabilities against any possible threat. Rear Admiral Sayyari stressed that Iran has made great progress in the drone industry in recent years, placing itself amongst the strongest in the region. The Iranian Army's Navy, ground and air forces will be taking part in the exercises starting on Tuesday. The drills aim to assess various types of homegrown unmanned aircraft, including reconnaissance and combat drones. Tehran has always stressed its military power poses no threat to anyone and serves as a deterrent. Journalist and political commentator Mohsen Abbas says Iran needs a very sophisticated defense mechanism because it is surrounded by U.S. and Israeli bases all around its borders.
Iran has a need for this military hardware and this defense of a very highly technological nature because they are up against virtually every border from Afghanistan through to Azerbaijan, through to Iraq and the Gulf itself. Iran is surrounded by the Anglo-Zionist imperialist military bases and missiles themselves. But of course, missiles is just one aspect. The standing army amounts to at least a million personnel in itself, so huge numbers. They've also advanced in terms of naval power, which they've been flexing their muscles on over the last kind of year or so, particularly with what I would describe as unconventional naval power, as well as the conventional sort. The most unconventional being speedboats, literally, which are now armed with very sophisticated missile capability, which is a threat to even the Seventh Fleet of the Americans, which is based out there in the Persian Gulf, in Bahrain and other ports. The bottom line is that Iran has a solution to virtually everything that the Americans and their Atlantic partners have in terms of their belligerent efforts to dominate that part of the world.
In a celebration of scientific excellence, Iran has honored five luminaries at the fifth edition of the Mustafa Award ceremony in the central Iranian city of Isfahan. The prestigious award was given to five scientists from Muslim countries during the closing ceremony on Monday. The awards were granted across four main categories, including life and medical sciences, as well as science and technology. Over 2,000 participants from 110 countries attended the scientific event. Mustafa Prize, also known as the Muslim Nobel, was established in 2012 as a symbol of scientific excellence and has been held biannually since 2015. It recognizes leading researchers and scientists in the Muslim world. Former member of British Parliament Lambert Opic joined us earlier from London to comment on the Mustafa Prize ceremony held in Iran. We asked him what such a prestigious scientific event signifies. Here's what he had to say.
Signifies one very simple thing, that those who love the human race, who love science, who love knowledge, who love our future, think only of improving things and using technology and also everything that is good in the human spirit to do that. And I listened to that speech, I was inspired by it, and I think to myself, why would anyone treat Iran differently to any other highly developed country in the world? It's because there are some countries who still think power is more important than progress. And although this is not a political discussion, anyone who is frightened of Iran should listen to that speech and welcome it.
Let's now turn to the Asian Games underway in the Chinese city of Hangzhou. Iranian athletes have grabbed two more gold medals, this time in discus throw and kurash wrestling. Discus throwers Hussein Rasuli and Ehsan Haddadi claimed the gold and silver medal, respectively. Rasuli threw over 62 meters to win the fifth gold for his country. In kurash wrestling, Sadir Azarang also clinched a gold medal. Iran ranks 11th in the overall medal tally for now. Over 12,000 athletes from 45 nations are taking part in the Asian Games. Iran has 289 male and female athletes in 34 sporting events. The leader of Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement deplores the normalization of ties between some Arab countries and the Israeli regime as a betrayal of Palestinians.
Any country heading towards normalization with Israel, when it signs a normalization agreement, must be condemned and its actions must be denounced. This matter goes beyond political relations and courtesy, because it's very dangerous as it represents a stab in the back of the Palestinian people, Al-Aqsa Mosque, as well as Islamic and Christian holy sites.
Said Hassan Nasrallah said normalization with Israel is also equal to abandoning Palestine and playing into the enemy's hands. He said countries that seek to normalize ties with Israel must be held accountable for their actions. This comes amid reports that Saudi Arabia may reach a normalization deal with Israel. Bahrain, along with the United Arab Emirates, signed U.S. brokered normalization agreements with Israel in September 2020. Two more Arab states, Morocco and Sudan, joined the accord later. The normalization sparked criticism from other Muslim countries. They argued that the move would embolden Israel in its crimes against Palestinians and harm regional peace and stability. Meanwhile, Israel has launched fresh air attacks on Syria, hitting targets near the city of Deir al-Zor. A Syrian military source has said the regime's warplanes pounded some of the Arab country's armed forces' positions. They said the raids left two soldiers injured and caused material damage. The regime frequently carries out such acts of aggression against Syria. Damascus says the attacks violate its national sovereignty. It has repeatedly complained to the UN and urged the Security Council to take action against Tel Aviv. Palestinians have held a rally in Gaza in support of the occupied Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque amid the escalating Israeli aggression. Protesters vowed to sacrifice their lives for the sake of their sanctities. Ashraf Shannon has more details from the besieged territory.
People in the blockaded Gaza Strip have held a demonstration in support of Al-Aqsa Mosque and occupied Al-Quds in the face of growing Israeli aggression against the Islamic holy site. Protesters shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and demanded an end to the Israeli occupation. Tensions have been on the rise in recent days in Al-Quds, with Israeli settlers backed by regime forces desecrating the city's Al-Aqsa Mosque. The Hamas movement to organize the rally vowed to continue resistance until the liberation of all of Palestine.
Al-Aqsa Mosque is not alone, and we will protect it with our lives. The desecration of our holy site and digging tunnels under it will never give legitimacy to the Zionist enemy. The Palestinian people are in a constant state of resistance, and their resistance will continue to increase until the liberation of Al-Quds and every inch of our land.
People came out to express their support for resistance as the best way to defend Al-Quds against Israeli attacks. They stressed that Al-Quds will always remain the capital of Palestine, despite the U.S. and Israeli plots to change its status.
Al-Aqsa Mosque belongs to every Muslim around the world and to every Palestinian. The Zionists are creating Al-Aqsa, and we believe that only armed resistance can liberate Al-Quds and all of Palestine.
Occupied by Israeli regime forces in 1967, Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque have been at the core of the Palestinian struggle for freedom and justice.
We are here to tell the whole world that Palestinians are willing to sacrifice their lives for the sake of liberating Al-Quds. We will not remain silent amid the attacks on Al-Aqsa. Al-Quds will always be a Muslim city.
Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque have a special place in the hearts of millions of Muslims around the world due to their religious significance.
Palestinians in the besieged coastal territory say they will use all forms of resistance against the Israeli occupation until the liberation of Al-Quds. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
In the Afghan capital, Kabul, a large ceremony was held to mark the birth anniversary of Prophet Muhammad and Islamic Unity Week. The event stressed the need for unity and solidarity amongst the followers of the Prophet of Islam. Here's more.
The Grand Khatam al-Nabiyyin Mosque in Kabul was the venue for the ceremony celebrating the Prophet Muhammad's birthday and the Islamic Unity Week. The ceremony drew people from all walks of life, including religious scholars, Taliban officials, and students. The speakers emphasized the need for following the path of Prophet Muhammad in all aspects of life and strengthening the Islamic bonds.
God has introduced the Prophet of Islam as the best role model for humanity. Prophet Muhammad is the role model because he is the mercy of God for us. Following his path will bless us luck and good in the life and the hereafter.
The attendees of the ceremony also expressed their views on the occasion. Many of them said they were happy to see Muslims from different sects coming together and celebrating their common faith. They also said they hoped for peace and stability in their war-torn country.
Western countries have always tried to divide Muslims. This has been one of their plots to implement their goals and dominate Muslim territories. But fortunately, today, all our Muslim brothers are aware and won't let anyone divide us or create hatred among us. We should work together for the prosperity and security of our Islamic world.
The Islamic Unity Week is an annual event that is observed by both Sunni and Shia Muslims around the world. This is also an opportunity for Muslims to celebrate their common values. Following decades of invasion and war in their country, Afghan Muslims have gathered today to show their unity and brotherhood. They also voice support for other Muslims across the world in the face of global arrogance and oppression. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump has once again appeared in court, this time over a case of civil fraud. The lawsuit is filed by New York Attorney General Letitia James. She has accused Trump and his family business of inflating the value of their assets by billions of dollars to secure better loan and insurance terms. If found guilty, Trump could face a fine of up to $250 million, a ban on running businesses in New York, and also a five-year restriction on commercial real estate activities. Trump, however, has denounced the case as a sham and part of a political witch hunt.
And now I have to go before a rogue judge as a continuation of Russia, 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 as a continuation of the greatest witch hunt of all time. And I don't think the people of this country are going to stand for it.
The trial is expected to last several weeks and could have a major impact on Trump's business empire. It marks the latest in a series of legal woes the ex-president and the frontrunner for the 2024 Republican presidential nomination is encountering. Trump already faces charges of sexual abuses, alleged mishandling of classified files, and attempts to overthrow the 2020 presidential election results. The former president keeps denying any wrongdoing. U.S. military support for Ukraine is coming under increasing criticism at home and abroad. The Mexican president has now strongly criticized the spending as irrational and damaging. Andrés Manuel López Obrador urged Washington to instead devote more resources to helping Latin American countries. The leftist López Obrador has vowed to keep Mexico neutral in the conflict and proposed peace talks to end it. The U.S. has sent more than $46 billion in military aid to Ukraine since the Russia-Ukraine war started in February 2022. However, last week, Congress passed an 11th-hour government funding bill that did not include aid for Ukraine. A new survey showed that a majority of Americans believe the U.S. has done enough to support Ukraine and would argue against allocating more funds for the country. Well, that's it for this hour's bulletin. Take care for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Unity Week. Unity, secret behind the might of Islamic world. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. The birth anniversary of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, is the best opportunity to pay attention to his human building teachings. As you know, the birthday of the Seal of the Prophets has been mentioned in two dates. According to the Sunni Muslims, he was born on the 12th of the Islamic month of Rabiul Awwal, while Shia Muslims maintain that the Prophet was born on the 17th of the month. Anyway, the great leader of the Islamic Revolution and the reviver of Islam in the modern era, Imam Sayyid Ruhullah Musavi Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, named the time span between the two days as the Unity Week to unite Muslims of all denominations in the face of the sworn enemies. On December 29th, 1981, the Imam said, "We shout that we should all be together to have Unity Week. Our religion is the same. Our Quran is the same. And our Prophet is the same." Every year, upon the initiative of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the International Islamic Unity Conference is held in order to bring Muslim thinkers and researchers together. In 1990, Ayatollah Khamenei ordered the formation of the World Forum for Proximity of the Islamic Sects, enhancement of familiarity, awareness, and deepening of comprehension among the followers of the Islamic sects and bolstering of Islamic Brotherhood are among the goals of this forum. The biggest harm for Islamic communities is to turn differences into spite and hostility. The enemies of Islam have tried, since the time of the Prophet, to sow discord among Muslims in a bid to reach their unholy goals. In the advent of Islam, the Prophet tried to create unity and affection between those who were the inhabitants of Medina, Ansar or helpers, and the migrants, Muhajirin, who had migrated from Mecca to Medina. The Seal of the Prophets, as per the verses of the Noble Quran, called on Muslims to cling to the divine cord and avoid any discord and disunity. Thus, Muslims became a monolithic united nation, Ummah, who in many cases triumphed over enemies. Enemies, however, understood the mystery of Muslims' victories very soon. Hence, they left no stone unturned to cause rifts among the ranks of Muslims. As soon as a variety of narratives were put forward about the teachings of the Quran and the statements of the Prophet, differences increased among Muslims. The biggest blows have been dealt to Islam and Muslims with the same differences. The message of the Islamic Revolution, since day one, has been unity and solidarity. The Islamic Revolution has always emphasized on tolerance and refraining from animosity. Ayatollah Khamenei says in this regard, "One of the tools that have always been used by the enemies of Muslim nations is the issue of sectarian differences, Shia and Sunni and so on. They caused quarrel, create difference, cause brothers to fight with each other, magnify differences, highlight them, weaken commonalities and elements of unity, undermine them, magnify a petty thing, highlight it, trivialize so many commonalities between Sunni and Shia brothers, and weaken them. This is what has always been done. Now it is being done too." The message of the Islamic Revolution has always been unity. In fact, this revolution achieved victory through unity of all ethnicities and sects under the leadership of Imam Khomeini. In view of this, Imam Khomeini kept calling for unity and did his best to expand the pattern of unity among other Islamic nations. As the Imam would say, "Unity does not mean to put aside one's religion. Islamic unity means to converge around common strong points against common enemies." In view of the Imam, unity is the factor of power, and discord is the cause of weakness and annihilation. He used to warn that discord existing among Muslim nations has originated in either the betrayal of the leaders or their ignorance and unawareness. Imam Khomeini said that there is no Sunni and Shia, Arab and non-Arab in Islam. We are all brothers in Islam. In a society where people want to render services to Islam, such issues have no place. We should never cause differences. Once he said, the Shia and Sunni brothers should refrain from any difference. Today, difference among us is only to the benefit of those who believe in neither Shia sect nor Hanafi sect or other sects. They want neither this nor that to exist. They have found a way to create difference among you and us. We should pay attention to the fact that we are all Muslims and we are all the people of the Quran and the people of Tawhid, monotheism. And we should make effort to render service for the Quran and Tawhid. Of Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, the pure Muhammadan Islam is the only solution and remedy for the pains of the Islamic communities. The pure Islam brings about unity among all Muslims from any race, ethnicity, or language spoken. Imam Khomeini called the pure Muhammadan Islam is the Islam of the suffering poor, the Islam of the barefooted, the Islam of those who have been whipped during the bitter and shameful history of deprivation. It is the Islam that smashes modern capitalism and bloodthirsty communism. It is the obliterator of the Islam of luxury, the Islam of eclecticism, the Islam of compromise and abasement, and in short, the American Islam. Thank you. KRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear sisters and brothers from all around the world. Welcome back to IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Viewpoint. I am Bita, and once again, I have the honor to be at your service as the host of today's episode. And today with me are two dear guest speakers, Brother Ali and Brother Habib with me. Welcome, brothers. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having us.
Thank you. You are looking at this concept actually somehow idealistically, okay? We're living in a world who we can see individualism everywhere, in families, in generations, and so on, okay? So the thing that you are telling me that we have to focus on the common thing is a bit far-fetched, okay? Mm-hmm. Because we are living in a world full of differences, okay? And we accepted these differences as something common, okay? We all have differences.
Uh-huh. It is not idealistic at all.
Why? Doesn't exist any unity?
Oh, okay, let me tell you. Because the enemy was very artistic. He focused on our mind and he changed our, mindset that we see that, okay, whatever we have is differentiation. No, we have a lot in common. Almost 90% of the beliefs of, even 90 plus percent of beliefs of Muslims are in different areas are very similar to each other at least.
So
it means that when you have, you cannot find such a thing in any other religion. And that you have all these, unity-making elements. So why should we talk about, for example, differences? Yeah, no, it is not idealistic at all. Mean. For example. Let me give you one example. You, as a Shia, need to prove yourself that you have only one Quran. This version of your Quran is the same book that is, for example, being read and recited in different countries.
Yeah.
But when you go outside of a country, you see, oh, too many people have another mindset about the Quran that you have. They say, okay, can you swear by God that you are reciting this Quran? You cannot believe it that in Islam world, some of the people think that we have another format of the Quran.
Yeah.
So you say, no, Quran is quite, there is no other version of Quran except the Quran that we have. But as Imam Saleh said, the one which is Bain al-Jildain.
Right. So I get your example, but let's have the opinion of Brother Habib too here.
Yeah, sure. The thing is that I think that you kind of missed what he was trying to state about the meaning of wahda, when we say wahdat or unity. What he was trying to point out and prove was that we can coexist, and it is possible.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to be perfect. There are going to be differences, but that's normal. Mm. As you stated, that families between themselves, they also have their differences, but yet they still coexist together. These elements of unity that he was stating also play a part of us having one Quran. Of course, the different ways of narrations, of recitations. In Africa, the 21 ways of reciting, the 7 famous ones, frequently reported ones, available as
but the differences are not too much. Eh?
Yeah, it's one Quran.
Yeah.
The one message of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala sent by the same prophet that we all believe in, Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, to face the same qibla that we all pray towards. And of course, the love of Ahlul Bayt alayhum as-salam. No Muslim, a true Muslim, does not always has the love of Ahlul Bayt.
In different parts of the world, we have some figures who are really defending this concept. So it does not mean that, okay, we are alone. No. Governmentally speaking, yes, Iran is the only country. No, but if in the world of Islam, with the scholars, there are too many scholars in both. But definitely, the Shia scholars are more in this way. In this,
When you look at the Shia history, from the time where they were always the minorities, and the Imam alayhi salam would always advise them, even in the words of Amir al-Mu'minin alayhi salam, we talked about this before the show. Even in the words of Amir al-Mu'minin alayhi salam. That they always advise to have unity, to always be with them as one. We even have the saying from Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam. It's available in Al-Kafi, where he sees a man holding a fish. He says, why are you doing this? Throw away the fish. Do not make us an embarrassment in front of others. Mm-hmm. Always perfume, always wear your best clothes, always do your, be in a good appearance. Why? Because they just want something on you. The thing is that we're opening our doors. But why aren't we receiving any, guests over? We've been trying it, the conference. I've been in the conference. I've seen the conference, Islamic Unity Conference placed. I've tried it. I've seen it. We said, why not? Let's see what good has. And the intentions are for the Shias are clear.
Mm-hmm. So this is exactly what the common enemy wants out from us, to reach to this point. Look, to give us this mindset that there is no way for unity between us. Definitely,
no, there is. No.
Even this conference.
There is a way.
Look,
the
functionality of this conference can be seen, I mean, tangibly. We can see the results of such conferences, at least one of
them. I mean, it's been a stretch of like at least 20 years where they've been trying to put Muslims together and whatnot. But
definitely,
in the
14th century, there was not such conferences. Now, with innovation of, for example, Imam Khomeini.
Let me just wrap the things up to here. You know, both have these things in common that it is possible to have unity in our Islamic Ummah, okay? But the problem, we are opening our doors. We are sharing this mindset that we want to be united with you. But, you know, they just don't want to do that. What should we do? After these long years, isn't it enough?
Put yourself in a state. Yeah. It's very difficult, of course, to put yourself in the place of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Yeah.
He knew that he was right. He knew it was true.
I know.
What was his stance at that time? He opened the door. He helped them, I mean, to the extent that he could. So this was the way that he acted. Let's go, I mean, down to Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, the same way. Some of the leaders of other denominations were students of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. You see, he taught them. He had the right of their being as a teacher.
Yeah.
So what was the stance of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam? Did he say anything against them? Or did act against them? But he always helped them. I mean, he was opening his arms to welcome them, to answer their questions. And even the second caliph, he said, if it was not Ali, the second caliph was annihilated. Imam opened his arms. So this is our duty. We do our duty. We are men of duty, not men of results.
But brother, they're taking it for granted, you know. They are getting used
but
to it.
But it shows its results. What is the result? The result will come up 25 years later, that Ali becomes the leader of the Islamic Ummah.
So what is
but
the line?
It does not mean that we are doing such a thing to, for example, conquer the world in the future. No, we are going. This is our duty.
Okay.
We do it for the sake
to what extent?
Of the Islam, to extend that we can.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
So, brother, how are you doing?
We do need the Islamic unity. We accept that. We all accept that, brother.
Okay.
We do accept the fact that we have been advised to do so. We are doing our part.
Excellent.
But what I'm trying to say here is that, you know, it's a two-way job. It's not only a one-way job.
Exactly.
You know, that's what I'm trying to say here, that we've been trying our best, but why aren't the other sects coming back to us? Can you please give us an analysis look on it? Like, why aren't the Hanafis coming? All right, yeah, the Shias are trying to put hands with each
Imam
other.
Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayhi, has a very famous statement. He says, we are missioned to our duty, not missioned to the result of what we are doing.
Nice.
ما مأمور بوظيفة ما مأمور بنتيجة. We don't care what the result is going to be. You see? The same way that you say, okay, I'm living in a life with, for example, my wife. This is my duty to be kind. Oh, I have to see I have to see something from the other side. Suppose that there is no, I mean, sign from the other side. Suppose, I mean, I'm making just to make it tangible.
No.
To make it tangible. Suppose that no good sign comes from the other side. So what is your duty? Your duty changes? You become harsh? You become wild to her?
No, but the thing is that you change your
methods. So you mean I do my duty, whatever is on me, I will do my duty, whatever is obligatory and mandatory on me. So I'm waiting, I did it for the sake of God. So I'm acting based on what Allah has put on my shoulder.
At the end of the day, there's not going to be any unity unless they
also Alhamdulillah there was. What you see in the world today, that the effect of this concept in the Islam world today is totally different with what was 40 years ago, Sheikh. You can go and see in different parts of the world.
I think that I think that technology played its role in understanding Shiism more. Otherwise, till this day, people who are far off from understanding the reality of Shiism are still stuck in that loophole of what Shiism are equivalent to worse than Jews. Still to this day. And I think that what really helped us out, and you saw it come less, is that we're out there more. We're on social media. Our websites are available, alhamdulillah, with the great struggle of our scholars. Our books are spread out. The ideologies of Shiaism is spread out there, where you could understand what is Shiaism from Shiaism. The works of Allama Tabataba'i played a big role in France and Europe as well. Don't forget about that. And the Sunnis know who Shias are. They understand what the Shias are. But yet still, they're scholars I'm talking. I'm not talking about the norm. Okay. But still, the norm are affected.
I want to say that this mindset that you are talking about, Sheikh, is not something quite widespread among the Muslims. It's I want to tell you, if anyone has been living among the Sunni brothers or Sunni communities, he easily can understand that this harsh viewpoint is among very, very, very few number of the Islamic Ummah that have been affected by the enemies. I can call them something like Wahhabi-oriented ones or Salafis or something like this. Not among... I can tell you more than 80 or 90% of them have not such mindsets or are not that much, let's say, harsh towards Shiaism. So our quarrel or discussion is for that minority that has been affected by the common enemy. And we are making, and we are defending this concept of Islamic unity to take these 20% of our brothers and sisters back from the enemy, right? I have been living among Ahl Sunnah, even in Iran, outside of Iran. So, I mean, I have been among them for quite a short period of time.
Yeah, Brother Ali, your defense was, I think, kind of perfect up to here. But all the questions that you asked about all these unity things that we open our doors and so on, they didn't answer. And the thing, I'm going to ask Brother Habib at the last part of our episode, which you have 2 minutes to answer, is we have to focus on our duty. Do you agree with that? And our duty to make ourselves united.
Yes.
More and more. Okay.
Yes, I accept.
So what do you do as an individual here to make it more stronger, to make it something for them to accept it?
I accept the fact that, yes, we have to do our duty. We are living currently in a Shia state. And it kind of becomes easier for us to forget even like the fact of how the other Shias were living before. And how they were viewed to some extent. And for example, if I was living in America, in the United States, between a Sunni community, it is available. And, or for example, I was living in Birmingham, England, full of Sunnis there. I would not show off that I'm a Shia. I would live with them like I'm another Muslim. I would pray in their masajid. I would do whatever. If the taqiyya reaches to a point where I have to do taktif, then I would do taktif.
Takattuf.
And then there's also this important factor of respecting them, being nice to them, even, you know, going to their funerals, their happy occasions, their sad occasions, being with them, living with them, coexisting with them all together. That's my duty, coexisting.
I think this is exactly what unity means.
That's what we're talking about. But the fact is, the problem is that it has somehow become political.
I know.
The factor of becoming together, you feel that it's political on both sides.
Yeah, I do agree with you. Because Islam is political religion.
Yes.
Imam Ali was a political leader at the same time, he was a religious leader.
We accept that.
Yeah.
We accept
definitely
that.
It's political.
But the thing is,
the whole religion is politics. The politics is, but this definition of politics differs with the politics in the Western.
That's what I wanted to say. That the fact is that there's always that common enemy. So it's like the longing from the Shia sect for Islamic unity. If we didn't have a political place, will it still be there, or will we change our duties?
Look, we are men of actions, men of duties. We act based on our duties. It might long up to the day of judgment, right? So we're men of duties. We have been created to be a good servant of God, as the Holy Prophet was servant of God. So we do our actions, our duties as a servant.
Thank you, Brother Ali and Brother Habib, for having your opinions with me and your point. And thank you, dear listeners, for listening to us. It was all the time we had for today's episode. I wish you farewell. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
shining bright, you came to us with a heart so full of love, and you showed that you're the one who cares the most, and to us you've always been so close. Everyone will say, please save me, accept Al-Habib. Ummati, Ummati, يقولها لنا يوم القيامة. Ummati, Ummati, يقولها شفاعة أنا لها.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
Germany's economy stagnated in the second quarter of this year compared to the previous 3 months, showing no sign of recovery from a winter recession and cementing its position as one of the world's weakest major economies. We take a look at some of the world media and press's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. RT Russia Today has covered this story and tells us more. The Federal Statistical Office, DStatis, reported on Friday, 25th of August, the German government budget deficit surged to 42.1 billion euros in the first half of 2023 amid Berlin's efforts to rein in inflation and energy prices. According to preliminary data, the figure was 37.6 billion euros higher than in the first half of 2022, a nearly tenfold increase. When measured against the gross domestic product, GDP, at current prices, the deficit ratio was 2.1%. According to the German Federal Statistical Office, DStatis, government revenue amounted to 917.2 billion euros in the reporting period, while expenditure was 959.3 billion euros. The latter spiked sharply since last year by 7.7%, largely due to the federal government's relief packages that aim to alleviate the pressure from high inflation and a surge in energy prices. The report stated the brakes on gas, heating and electricity prices and the related hardship clauses applying to hospitals and care facilities caused a sharp rise in subsidies by 45.7% in the first half of 2023, year on year. It noted that additional expenditures came from the reform of federal funding for energy-efficient buildings, which sparked a rise in investment grants. Meanwhile, the government's interest payments were up 38% in the first half of 2023 compared to the same period in 2022. Despite remaining the European Union's largest economy, Germany has been struggling with the fallout from the energy crisis and persistently high inflation since last year. Heavily reliant on energy imports from Russia, the country was among the hardest hit by the reduction in Russian energy deliveries to Europe, which were either significantly curtailed or entirely halted after the European Union imposed sanctions on Moscow in response to the conflict in Ukraine. This resulted in elevated energy costs, which in turn have been driving up prices in other sectors of the economy. According to recent forecasts, energy prices in Germany are likely to remain high until at least 2027, which means that additional support measures may be necessary to avoid another crisis. The Wall Street Journal has also covered the same story and tells us more. According to a survey of companies, business sentiment in Germany weakened in August for the fourth month in a row, and by more than expected, as the economic outlook turns gloomier in Europe's largest economy. Data from the IFO Institute said on Friday, 25th of August, the IFO Business Climate Index declined to 85.7 in August, from 87.4 in July, missing expectations of 86.6 by economists polled by the journal. The reading was the lowest level since October of last year. Clemens Foest, president of the IFO Institute, said companies are increasingly pessimistic about the months ahead. IFO Institute's indicator gauging current conditions tumbled to 89.0 from 91.4 in July, the lowest level since August of 2020. Meanwhile, the survey said its index, assessing expectations for the next 6 months, also ticked down to 82.6 in August from 83.6 in the previous month. IFO Institute said in manufacturing, expectations remained starkly pessimistic, with companies suffering from declining new orders. The business climate index was also weaker on months in IFO's other tracked sectors, services, trade and construction, with the outlook turning gloomier in all three sectors. The survey comes after Germany's economy was confirmed to have stalled in the second quarter of this year after contracting in the first quarter of 2023 and the last quarter of 2022. The IFO index is based on a poll of about 9,000 companies in manufacturing, services, trade and construction sectors. The Reuters news agency has also covered the same story. Germany's economy stagnated in the second quarter of this year compared to the previous 3 months, showing no signs of recovery from a winter recession and cementing its position as one of the world's weakest major economies. The figure of zero growth for the second quarter of this year was in line with a first estimate published in late July. Year-on-year adjusted gross domestic product contracted by 0.2% in the second quarter of this year, Quarter-on-quarter, economic activity has fallen by 0.4% in the fourth quarter of 2022 and by 0.1% in the first quarter of 2023. Two consecutive quarters of contraction fulfills the technical definition of a recession. Carsten Brzeski, global head of macro at ING Bank, said both the short-term and the longer-term outlook for Germany looks anything but rosy. Carsten Brzeski said weak purchasing power, thinned out industrial order books, a slowdown in the Chinese economy, and the impact of the most aggressive monetary policy tightening in decades all point to weak economic activity in Germany going forward. Friday, 25th of August's data showed household consumption showed zero growth in the second quarter of this year from the first quarter, and government spending rose by 0.1%. Capital investment also grew modestly, whilst exports fell by 1.1%. Pantheon Macroeconomics forecast gross domestic product, GDP, will post a 0.2% contraction in the third quarter of this year, before a rebound of 0.4% quarter-on-quarter in the last quarter of this year. That would mean that Germany's gross domestic product falls by 0.2% year-on-year in 2023. Melanie de Bono, senior Europe economist at Pantheon Macroeconomics, said, if our forecasts for the rest of the big four Eurozone economies are correct, this means Germany will be the worst performing economy among them. According to a monthly report published on Monday, 22nd of August, the Bundesbank expects economic output to remain largely unchanged in the third quarter of this year. The report claimed a resilient labour market, strong wage increases and declining inflation should boost private consumption, but it admitted industrial production will remain weak because of sluggish foreign demand. Also, the Bundesbank said Germany's economy will likely stagnate again in the third quarter of this year as weak demand from abroad and high interest rates take their toll on Europe's industrial powerhouse. Germany's central bank said in its monthly report, after preliminary estimates suggested that the economy recorded zero growth in the second quarter of 2023, the outlook for the July to September period was not much better.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Your headlines for this hour: Iran's president strongly condemns the sacrilegious act on the Holy Quran in some countries as an insult to humanity, freedom, and spiritual values.